Thank you very much for inviting me here. So, I'll be discussing again, following Qin, some developments in this important field in physics, which is the EDS-CFT duality. So EDS-CFT is a duality between two quantum theories in physics. One theory which describes gravity, this is the left-hand side, which describes strings, so moving in some curved space-time. And then there is the other theory, which is somehow a particle physics theory, a theory which describes, like the one that describes the microscopic particles in nature, but a special one in the case that I'm going to discuss. So it's a quantum field theory like those describing particle physics. And this duality tells us that gravity in some curved space-time with some number of dimensions is equal to a particle theory in another number of dimensions in another space-time, which actually is a flat space-time. Integrability means, when a system is integrable, means that we can solve it, basically, for short. For mathematicians, it would mean that there are lots of charges, lots of conserved integrals of motion. I mean, we could be more precise. For a physicist, it means that we can solve it. Okay. Very good. So these are complicated quantum theories. So let me describe a bit what is the easy. So this theory, there is a very important parameter, which we will be speaking a lot about, which is G, which is a coupling. So all these theories, they have a parameter that you can tune, which is a coupling. And the theory has a regime, which can be, say, this G going to zero or G going to infinity, where the theory becomes very simple. So, for example, if you turn off interactions and particles move freely and they don't scatter and in your detectors. Or when these strings, they are just described by some classical equations of motion, some solving some differential equations, and they don't quantum fluctuate. So there is this important parameter, and let me describe a bit what are these theories in the easy regime of this parameter. So ADS, in the easy regime, so the ADS part, in the easy regime is about solving the mathematical involved, is about solving partial differential equations. This is all there is. So you have your string. Okay? The string is parametrized, so there is a sigma, which you can take to go from 0 to 2 pi, which parametrizes where you are on your string. This is at some given time. I took a picture. This is the string. At some other given time, the string will be at some other position. So there will be time evolving to go from one configuration to the other. Okay? And this configuration of string, okay, for each sigma and tau, the evolution, both in sigma and in tau, are given by some partial differential equations that we solve to describe the motion of the strings. Okay. The easy part of the conformal field theory is doing perturbation theory in the field theory. So the conformal field theory, we can think that it's like a statistical model where you are summing over configurations of fields and you have some diagrammatic rules for computing these averages. Okay, for computing these averages. So it's like we compute averages, momenta of some distributions. And the kind of things that we have to do is, the things that are involved is, if you want, some graph theory, some very, very elementary graph theory. So we have to draw simple graphs. This is the kind of things that we do. We draw some simple graphs. And we compute some integrals. Okay, so there is a way of computing averages in this physics theory, which amounts basically you draw a couple of simple pictures, and then to each picture there is an associated integral, which is called the Feynman integral that you have to do. So here is the kind of graph that you would draw. So let me draw it, and then I'll explain what this is. So you will draw two one-dimensional structures like this. Here I'm choosing a particular example. And then you would connect them. And you could have, for example, something like this. So this would represent, you can think of this as four fundamental particles. They moved from this region to this region, and two of them interacted by exchanging a particle. Okay? And there is a way of computing, so if this interaction happened in some point in space-time X, and if this happened at some point in space-time Y, you sum over histories, over ways that these four particles evolved to these four particles by integrating over the position X and integrating over the position Y. And these are the kind of integrals that you need to do. So there are a rule of associating to each picture a given integral, and that gives you a number that you want to compute. Okay? And the physics of this is describing exactly the sum over history from one side to the other. So as I said, the goal of this CFT is to compute average of distribution. So this guy is the kind of thing that we want to we compute average of operators, like Shein was describing. And here, this operator would be a trace of a product of fields. So the fields in this theory are matrices. Okay, it's a gauge theory. It's an unabelian gauge theory. The fields are matrices. And here I have 4 points, so this would be a trace of a product of 4 fields of the theory, which I could call Z and X, for example. Okay? So there is this notion of trace of products of fields. I mean, matrices, when you multiply them, you cannot exchange the order, so this defines the one-dimensional structure. Here is the one-dimensional structure. Here is another one-dimensional structure. Here is the string evolving from this initial position to this final position. Here is the one-dimensional structure evolving from this configuration to this configuration. Okay? And the ADS-CFT correspondence maps these two kinds of structures and tells you that there is a precise sense in which these two diagrams have to be identified. Okay? This easy regime of the theory is the regime you define a theory. So far, suppose we define them completely independent. Conventionally here, you reach the regime where you can study strings by just solving differential equations in the limit when g goes to infinity. And here, in the usual convention, you reach this regime where you need to do some very simple graphs when g goes to zero. So very, very different regions. Here, we see that we have a one-dimensional continuous structure. Just a string. And here, we have a one-dimensional structure, again, just a trace of our operators. It's a one-dimensional structure again, but it's a one-dimensional discrete structure. Okay? And here it's a one-dimensional continuous structure. Okay, very good. So, and the claim is that this should somehow be identified, so that the idea of the ADS-CFT correspondence is, suppose you compute some quantity in this size. Say, suppose you compute the energy, for example, of the string. So the energy is some functional of the shape of the string. Okay? So as I said, this would be the coupling. When the coupling is very large, it's simple. So this is easy, this part here. And here we enter the regime where it's hard, where you need to study quantum strings. This is hard. On the other hand, here, we start with something which is easy. So when we expand this graph in perturbation theory, the first graph gives something in G, the second graph G squared, and so on. We have some Taylor expansion around here, and here we have what we call perturbative conformal field theory, or quantum field theory, which is easy, and then we get something which is hard. Okay? And what ADS-CFT tells you is that these curves are exactly the same. Okay? When you identify properly what you plot. Here, for example, you plot dimensions of operators. Okay? Which is a concept in a conformal field theory, the way the operators decay when you separate them a lot, which is related very much to that propagation. Okay, so why is this? So this is the ADS-CFT conjecture. Well, why is it still a conjecture? Why wasn't it proven? Well, because of the basic reason that when we know how to do a computation in one of the theories, we don't know how to do it on the other theory. And when we know how to do it in one theory, we don't know how to do it on the other theory. That's what it makes why it is so hard to prove, but that's also why it makes what it makes it so interesting. Because it allows us, if you want to do some theory in, say, some you have a theory of particles, and you have no clue how you will study particles when the quantum interactions are huge. Okay? So, I mean, this is of course not the theory of particles that we want to study at the LHC, but suppose it's but there are some similarities, and suppose we want to study something at very, very strong coupling, when the quantum effects are huge, very important. And I mean, just drawing graphs, we are not going to go very far. I mean, we are always going to stay here. But we want to go here, so how can we do it? Well, if we use the LCST, it's very simple. We just study motions of things. Now, of course, a priori, this looks absolutely ridiculous. How could these things be equal? So we have a one-dimensional continuous structure, a one-dimensional discrete structure. They are one-dimensional, but one is discrete, one is continuous. The idea is that you start in a continuous, with this continuous structure, you start decreasing G, and somehow the string will start becoming discrete, and will start becoming more quantum, and it will somehow, a string will become this one-dimensional discrete structure. Okay? And it's fun that, I mean, it really looks a bit like crazy, so these strings, they move in a space called ADS5 times the spot, n-dimensional space. The field theory lives in four dimensions. It's really something very, very weird. So actually, Joe Polchinski, which is a very known string theory, recently published a review, and I was just seeing it the other day, and at the end of the first chapter, he has two exercises. And the first exercise is find some argument or arguments which tell you that a 10-dimensional theory of quantum gravity cannot be equal to a 4-dimensional gauge theory. And then the second exercise is show that your arguments are wrong. Because they should be somehow, because we know that this works beyond any reasonable doubt. Okay, very good. So let's then describe a bit. Now I want to start describing. On this side of the blackboard, I will describe the string side. On this one, the CST side. And we will see on a precise quantity how exactly we will obtain a match between the two. And the idea is, of course, that we need to develop new tools to get to these regions here. Okay? So these regions here, they require new tools. Just doing what we are used to do will not be enough. We will not reach this region. And this new tool is what goes by the name of integrability. These new techniques, these new mathematical techniques that allow us to go beyond the traditional way of doing things. Okay, so let's consider strings, classical strings, which move in a subspace of this ADS5 type of five, which move in a three-sphere, say. This is just for simplicity. A three-sphere is something extremely simple. So let's consider strings in a three-sphere. And this is nice because a three-sphere is just SU2, right? I mean, S3 is just SU2, which is just SU3, up to some D2, right? For us, we don't care. And therefore, what I mean is that this position of the string at a given sigma and tau is given by, so these strings are described by a map which maps a cylinder. Okay, so this is a cylinder, this is sigma, and this is tau. This is what is called the world sheet. So for each sigma and tau, we map it to a three-sphere. And the three-sphere is nothing but an element H, which depends on sigma and tau, which is an element of SU2. Okay? This is just some 2x2 matrix. Okay? So here, I mean, for physicists, this is harmless. So what do I mean by this is just a 2x2 matrix? Of course, I'm already speaking about a representation. So this is the fundamental representation of SU2, which is the simplest one. Okay? Good. So this is H is in the fundamental representation of SU2. And we have some map which describes sigma and tau into H. So if you give me H, an element of SU2, I can translate it. What does it mean for a string moving in S3? And then the evolution of the string, the evolution is given by a partial differential equation, which I'm going to write. So you pick your element H, and, okay, let me write it, and then, I'm not sure which notation people prefer, but it's just this. You pick the element H, you construct a form which is H, d, H minus 1, you impose that this star of this form, this is just odd dual, is equal to 0. Okay? So let me be extremely explicit so if someone doesn't understand this notation. This just means, with all components and so on, it just means that you have solved the following equation. D tau h minus 1 d tau h minus d sigma h minus 1 d sigma h equal to 0. Okay? So it's just a function of sigma and tau, and it obeys this differential equation where h is a 2 by 2 matrix in SU2. Okay? So we choose some initial shape at some tau equals 0. We choose some shape of the string when tau is equal to 0, say, and then we evolve it in time through this equation. Okay? Is this clear to everyone or not? Because we choose because of the signature. So it's, this is time, this is space. So because it's Lorentzian, the Welch is Lorentzian. Any other question? We just need to solve this differential equation. Now, this is hard to solve. It's a strongly coupled system, so these equations are very hard to solve. And in practice, we don't solve them. We map it to a different problem. I need to eat some spinach. So now the idea is that we construct a connection, H. So this is where we do a trick. We define a new connection, H, which is the following. It's defined by a new form, which is H minus 1 dH. It's a linear combination of H minus 1 dH and the odd of H minus 1 dH. So in components, the sigma component here becomes the tau component. And the linear combination of the two we call X. So X belongs to C, it's a complex number. It's called the spectral parameter. And we have some linear combination constructed in a particular way. So this definition. Now, the equations of motion, which is the evolution, this partial differential equation for H, are equivalent to the flatness of A of x for any x. Okay? So if I impose that A is flat, let me recall that A is flat means that dA plus A wedge A equals to 0. You impose that this is true for all x, then this is equivalent to those equations of motion. Okay, just plug and see. Okay? Is this clear? Concept? Now, this has an important consequence. Whenever you have a flat current in physics, you like to construct autonomies with this current. And you construct autonomies with this contour, and the autonomies are independent of the path that you choose to make this contour. Okay? So, let's construct an autonomy. So, I was not sure at all how mathematicians usually like to define them. I suspect that not with path order exponentials. Right? So, let me define it through a differential equation. Probably this is better. So, we construct the following object, derivative with respect to sigma minus A sigma. So I could do it without components, but let me do it with components. It's simply simpler. Acting on some psi, so recall, this is a matrix, right? These are matrix values. So this is a 2 by 2 matrix as well. It depends on sigma and tau. Tau, we take it to be fixed. And we impose that this is equal to 0. We fix the boundary condition. Here there is a 2 by 2 identity. We fix the boundary condition that psi of 0 and tau is the identity matrix. And then the object we want is psi omega, which depends on x, which is nothing but psi at 2 pi and tau. Okay? So, in other words, so we have our cylinder. We start at some point. We go around. We compute the autonomy of A around this. We start at 0. We go back to the same point, so at 2 pi. Right? And we compute this omega, which is nothing but the autonomy, so the path order exponential of the integral of A around this path gamma. Okay, so I'm not sure if you are used to this notation. This means roughly the solution to this differential equation. Okay, very good. So why is this object interesting? So okay, this is just definition. So there is a definition here. There is another definition here. Why is this definition useful? So how do we describe the motion of some classical system, a string which is moving in space? So one thing you can tell is the string has a given energy and a given angular momentum. Okay, this is one way of describing it. Of course, one way of describing it is just giving the shape. Okay, but if you are, say, describing it in another way, is you say, oh, I'm seeing a string, it has some energy and some angular momentum. Some two quantities which are conserved when the string is evolving. So this is not enough, because there are many strings which have the same energy and the same angular momentum, slightly different shapes. But if you would have many more conserved quantities, instead of energy and angular momentum, if you would have many more, many other quantities which would also be conserved, this would be enough to describe the string. And this is what this guy gives. Because what happens is that because of this connection, A, that we use to build this holonomy is flat, the eigenvalues, or say the trace of this object, doesn't depend on where we put it. Okay? So let's write this. So because A is flat, it implies that the evolution of this object as we evolve tau is just by conjugation, just evolved by conjugation. And therefore, the derivative with respect to tau of, say, for example, the trace of omega of x or the eigenvalues of x is equal to zero. It actually does not depend on tau. But this is the definition. This means that trace of omega of x is a conserved quantity or a conserved charge, as we call in physics. It's a conserved, it's an integral of motion. But it's a conserved charge for any x, for any complex number x. So it means if I expand around some value, say I expand and I say I have some q naught plus x minus some x naught times some q1 plus etc. All these guys, they are conserved. And this value is whatever I want. Right? Because, I mean, for any x, it must be conserved, so any coefficient of a Taylor expansion must be conserved. So here it is. So I got immediately an infinite set of conserved charges, and now I can describe it over the phone and say q0 is blah, q1 is blah, q2 is blah, and I describe the solution completely because I'm giving you infinitely many conserved charges. So not all systems can be described in this way. Not all differential equations, I can find such infinite set of integrals of motion. This would be great. I mean, it's, I mean, that partial differential equations would be solvable. But this one, you can. So strings describe moving in some very, very symmetric spaces, like, for example, a sphere here. So strings moving in spheres, they are integrable. You can describe many integrals of motion and describe the motion exactly. So the kind of equations of motion are simpler than usual. Here, for example, let me make a side remark. One typically uses a trick to study this quantity. Instead of studying now solutions to partial differential equations, we want to find functions of x with certain prescribed analytical properties. So this omega of x came from the past order exponential of a connection. This connection is perfectly regular. It has poles at 1 and minus 1 only. There, you see, it has singularities at 1 and minus 1. So the problem of studying equation of motion translates into the problem of describing meromorphic functions with some given singularities. Okay? And this is a simple subject in algebraic geometry, and you can make a catalog of all possible algebraic functions omega of x that you might get. And in this way, you describe all possible string solutions. Okay? Without actually ever studying them and solving the equations of motion. Okay, cool. So here we took, as I said in the beginning, we took SU2. So far, omega was in the fundamental. So this is box, the Young tableau of the fundamental. Ah, okay. Okay, so we define this omega, which was in a fundamental representation of SU2. So in terms of... Okay. So far, omega was in the fundamental representation of SQ2. Okay, it's just a young tableau. Okay, in general, and actually, for the case we are interested in other group manifolds, more complicated group manifolds, because we want to describe strings moving in bigger space-times, and we might be interested in generic representations. Okay, so these are two directions of generalizations. For example, even in SU2, for example, we could take other symmetric representations, right? We could take a symmetric representation with, say, S boxes. Okay, also in SU2. And we could even replace SU2 by some other group, say, more complicated groups like SU8, for example. Okay, SU8 is a bigger group. Or, for example, another group which is very useful, which is called PSU2,2/4. And if you didn't, this is a supergroup. If you did not hear about it, 2 + 2 + 4 = 8. This is roughly SU8. Okay, there are some signatures. It's super and so on. But I mean, morally speaking, it's SU8. Okay, very good. So, and these, for example, are the kind of groups. This in particular is the one that describes superstrings in the full glory of ADS-CFT. But for the purpose of illustration, let's stick to SU2 for the moment. Okay, very good. When we start playing with different representations, okay, we have some representations, say, in the fundamental. We multiply two representations, fundamental times fundamental, and we start getting, say, symmetric, anti-symmetric representation, etc. Okay? Very good. So now I want to... And this is something that we could have wanted to do. We could have taken this omega here. We could have taken this connection, converted it into some other representation, and taken this group element in some other representation of SU2, say, some other symmetric representation. Okay? And then, what we want to consider to make these conserved quantities, we want to consider the trace of omega. This is what we were interested in. So what is a trace of a group element in a given representation? This is a character, right? This is something that we are using in mathematics. So this is a character. So let me recall a couple of facts about characters. Okay. So a character, what is a character? Definition of a character is a trace in a given representation lambda of a group element, let's call it omega, in the representation lambda. This is what is defined as the character of a given representation. Okay. Now, how is this lambda characterized? Lambda can be characterized by some Young tableau. This is a standard way of describing representations, say, at least for SUN groups. So you have some Young tableau like this, and this is the way of describing any representation. Okay? Is this okay? So a Young tableau, it has, say, lambda 1 boxes here, lambda 2 boxes here, up to lambda n boxes here, and let this height be 8. Okay, very good. Then, there is a beautiful formula by Jacobi and Trudy, which tells you how to get this character in a given representation if you know characters in simpler representations. Sorry? It will fall down? Okay, but I have some time, right? So, let me try. So, the T in a given representation lambda, okay, parametrized in that way, is equal, this is this Jacobi-Trudy formula, okay, this really is not a good idea. Okay. Ah, but this is also not a good idea, because then it will fall, this one. Ah, only this one, okay. Okay, T lambda is given by the following formula in terms of some fundamental building blocks, which are the transformations associated with the symmetric representations. So symmetric representations is the simplest, right? I mean, you have vector, and it's symmetrized, and it's symmetrized a bit more. I mean, this is really the simplest possible representation you have. So let me put some brackets to indicate. Okay. Lambda is equal to the following, is given by the determinant. So this is Jacobi and Trudy, I think. This is by Jacobi and Trudy. This is the determinant of matrices of size A. So A was the height of the Young tableau. of the character of a symmetric representation where the number of boxes here is lambda I plus I minus j. Okay? Recall lambda I was the number of boxes in row I. So lambda 1 is 1, lambda 2 is 2, lambda 3 is 4, lambda 4 is 4, and so on. So this is a very nice formula which tells you how to construct characters in any representation if you know the characters in the symmetric representations. So it's a group theory, very beautiful formula. And in particular, this implies, it's actually equivalent in some sense, but okay. To be rigorous, it implies the so-called Virota or Q-system relation. So I don't know if someone is, if anyone is familiar, which is the following. If you have a character, and let's consider a character for some special representations which are, have a very nice property that when you multiply these representations and you construct a product of these representations, they stay within themselves. It's a closed, some representations that don't mix with each other, which are rectangular representations. So when you have a rectangular representation with A boxes here as usual, and here let me denote the number of boxes S, then there is a very nice formula which tells that if you multiply, if you take TAS square, this is equal to TAS plus 1, TAS minus 1, plus TA plus 1, S, TA minus 1, S. Okay? Just TT equals TT plus TT. This is called the Q system or Virota equation. Okay, good. So if you want, I mean, if you take now your solutions of, let's recapitulate. So you take your solution of string theory, you construct your flat connection in any given representation, okay? And then, because you are dealing with group elements and with traces of group elements, you generate some characters which obey this equation, okay? So this equation, let's say it came from the classical string side. By side, I mean that in ADS-CFT we have the two sides of the correspondence. This came from the classical string side, from the continuous side. And now in the discrete side, we will see how this equation here arises in a very different way, and then we will identify the two equations. Now, the, of course, you might say, what is this? This is not really an equation. Okay, yeah, this is an equation. But to some extent, this is roughly an identity. It's not really an equation as much as it is an identity. Now, the idea is that this is the usual trick in integrability. You start with a trivial identity, which is an identity. It's satisfied because it's an identity, not really an equation. But once you say that all these guys, they have the same kind of analytic properties, this is already a very highly, a very non-trivial fact. So, for example, imagine you say you have this identity and all these t's need to be polynomials, then it turns into an equation that you can solve. So again, this is of course an identity, but then you you look at where these omegas came from, they must be meromorphic functions and so on, you supplement this identity with analytic properties, and then it turns out that you can extract juice out of it. Okay, anyway. I'm trying to give just an overview, so I won't go into more details about that. So this is what we got from string theory. And now the picture is that as we start turning off the coupling, the string becomes discretized, and it becomes this kind of one-dimensional structure. So this one-dimensional structure we have this trace, you have these traces of products of fields. So let's look at discrete systems. So let me think, do I really need to say this? Okay. So we have now, let's think about discrete systems, not discontinuous systems. Okay. And here I said that I can put some fields, for example, in the example I gave, I put some Z matrix, X matrix, or Z matrices in each of the fields. This was the example I gave there. I said X, Z, X, Z. Okay? Now, we physicists prefer to think of it. This is just, I mean, a mental problem. I mean, we like to think in terms of spins. So we like to think of this as thinking that we have an up arrow, a down arrow, an up arrow, and a down arrow. Okay? Then we have this picture. We think of it mentally that we have some particle which has a magnetic moment in the other direction, and they will interact, and we have some physical pictures that help us think. Okay? But you can think that this is just notation. Okay? Just to help me not write mistakes. Okay, good. So then we have the all possible operators of this form, which describe a vector space where at each point I can choose an X or a Z field. So there is a Hilbert space, H, which is a tensor product of many copies of, say, that here there are two options. So this would be, in this example, N equal to 2. There would be two options, one or two. And I could consider a linear combination of these guys, Cn times Cn times Cn. And how many times do I consider? As many times as operators. So this would be L, and in this picture, L would be equal to 4. Okay? So there is this notion of Hilbert space, which is the space of all possible operators. And then, this dimension, delta, that we can compute the dimension of operators, they are the eigenvalues of a matrix H, which is a matrix which acts on the Hilbert space into the Hilbert space, okay? Which you can compute by drawing this kind of graph. So this is the kind of graph that you draw in perturbation theory. The first graph is an interaction between this point and this point. This is the physics language. The second graph could interact a bit further and so on. So there is a notion of length and so on. And this matrix takes a very simple form, actually. It is just the leading order in perturbation theory. As I said, there is a G times something plus G squared times something plus etc. Let me describe what this is. This is just the sum over the size of the spin chain. And you have the... In all other sides, you do nothing. So you have identity times identity times identity. So this happens n minus 1 times. Okay? And then you have the permutation operator acting on sides n and then plus 1. Tensor identity, tensor identity. So basically what you do is you have some operator, you go on all possible pairs, and you exchange them one by one. And this is what this matrix does. Okay? So it acts on an operator by summing over all possible pairs and exchanging the operators. Okay? And your goal is to compute all eigenvalues of this matrix. And then you solve the problem to leading order, and you can draw the way it deviates from the origin. And then you need to compute the second guy and diagonalize to find the curvature, and so on. Okay? Now, how do we find integrability in this notion of diagonalizing these matrices and so on? So, the way we like to think, this is why this spin chain picture is useful for us, we like to think of this matrix H, which I defined here, as generating some dynamics for these spins. We like to think that this permutation, what's happening, is that these magnetic moments are being exchanged by some dynamics, if you want. And then what we want to study is what are the energies of this spin chain. These eigenvalues of this operator, which we call Hamiltonian, is nothing but the energies of the spins. Okay? So we want to study the energies of these spins. So we want to think of this H, in this language of putting arrows, this H is an Hamiltonian. And this delta are energies of the spin. Now, this H generating some dynamics, what does it mean to have conserved, to have all this infinite number of conserved charges? It means that we want an operator T, now it's an operator, T of U, U is a complex number now, like X was before, which commutes with H for any U. Okay, this is the analog of saying that derivative with respect to time of a classical operator is zero. Because if we can construct this operator that commutes with Hamiltonian for any U, we can do the same trick, and we can expand this equation at some value of U, whatever value you want again, and get in this way an infinite number of conserved charges. So that equation, if you expand, it gives you that H commuting with Qn U minus some value U0 to the N, sum over N is equal to zero for any U. So it means that you found exactly a tower of conserved charges. Okay, so cool. So this is exactly what we want. Now, let me tell you what this operator is without any proof, but let me tell you what it is. there is a family of such operators actually that you can construct. So let me know how to construct this operator P, which actually for any group, for example, here I have Cn times Cn times Cn. This would be naturally a spin chain associated with Sun symmetry. Okay? So if n is equal to 2, it's Su2 symmetry. It's 2 by 2 matrices which act on this C2 space. For n, the natural candidate would be a spin chain with Sun symmetry. And either in Su2 or in Sun, I can have different representations. And it's possible to construct a T which depends on this representation. And it's constructed in the following nice form. So to construct this, I need to introduce... Okay, let me write the formula, which is quite nice, and then let's explain the notation. And what's beautiful about this formula is that it's constructed from characters. You start with a character of some group element. Let's call it not omega. Let's call it... what other letters there are? Eta, for example. Okay? We start with a character, and a character is a number. Okay? There is a number which obeys those equations. And then, what we do, at the end of the day, this eta is just auxiliary, it goes to the identity. But what we do is we apply an operator, which we call coderivative, which I will explain what it is, which is an operator which, if you want, gives life to the character. And this is an operator which every time you act with this coderivative, this u is a complex number, it comes multiplied by the identity. Each time you apply this block, you create two indices, if you want. So by applying L times, you get now a big operator which acts on the Hilbert space into the Hilbert space. Right? So this guy, this T here, recall that this T, if I want this T, acts on the Hilbert space into the Hilbert space. So T, in a physicist way with indices, it has indices I1 up to IL, J1 up to JL, where all these indices run from 1 to n. And the way to generate these indices from something which is just a scalar is by acting with this coderivative. And each time I act, it opens indices. So let me define what this coderivative is. This coderivative, acting on... Can you read it right here? This coderivative, acting on any function of g, is defined in the following way. Pick that function and consider the action on G by exponential as E dot phi times G. Take derivative with respect to phi. I will give an example in a second so that you can all understand what this is. And then set phi to zero. So what is E dot phi? E dot phi is the sum over alpha and beta of E alpha beta phi alpha beta. So this is a matrix in the fundamental. And this E are the generators of GLN in the fundamental. So E alpha beta are matrices. The components IJ are just delta I alpha delta J beta. So that's a matrix which has one in a particular entry and zero everywhere else. So you construct this, you take the derivative, so this is like derivative respect to phi ij of this object, and this gives you two new indices, right? So this object here has two new indices. So let me just write an example. So do I have time? Oh, yes, I have lots of time. Good. So then let me work out an example so that you can see how this works. So let me put all indices. I mean, maybe putting indices for this audience is just more painful than to giving the definition. I'm not sure. But let me do it. So this guy, as I said, it opens two new indices. So there will be two new indices, I1, J1. Now let's consider the simplest function of the group element as the group element itself in the fundamental. So we have G, I2, J2. So what are we told to do? We are told that this is nothing but derivative with respect to phi, which has components. When we take derivatives, we put things like this. I1, J1, this is how you take derivatives to matrix elements. Okay, so this J1 is downstairs. With respect to this line, J1 is here, I1 is upstairs, it must be very down. So, that's good. And then, we have e to the phi dot e, acting on g, component i2 j2. And this is what? Now I expand, because I'm going to put phi equal to 0. So I expand to linear order this. So this is g i2 j2. This one is useless. I'll take derivative, it's 0. And then there is the other one, which is interesting, which is, let's use that definition, phi alpha beta. Then there is e alpha beta i2 k g k j2. So if I did not do any mistake, this is what it is, plus terms with phi square, which are 0, and I put phi equal to 0 after taking one derivative. Now I take one derivative of this phi with respect to this phi, I get some delta functions, this is some other Kronecker delta functions, I do all the contractions, and at the end of the day, I get, for example, this is an example, delta J1 I2 delta G times the group element G J2 I1. So what happens was that if you want this I indices, which I call incoming indices, were swapped. And now G, which was I2 J2, I1 is exchanged with it, and it became swapped. So in a nicer notation, the way I would like to write this is saying that, for example, this D acting on this G, so G, it acted in a single space, becomes an object which acts on two spaces, which is the permutation operator that we defined before, identity tensor G. Now this is an example of this action on G. Okay? So you see, for example, another example is D acting on trace of G. So it is just trace of this equation, just contract I2 with J2, you get just G. So you see, you act once with a derivative on a number, you get something which acts on one quantum space. You act again with another derivative on that something, you get something that acts on a product of two quantum spaces. And so on. And you are increasing, and what you are doing is you start with a character, and we start building a spin chain by acting with these quantum operators. So this is how characters become physics quantum spin chains. And now comes something very nice, because now we created quantum spin chains from, if you want, classical characters. So now we can go to mathematics books, find equations written from group theory, such as this one, or this one, which come purely from group theory, and we can quantize group theory. We can apply this co-derivative and see what happens to these equations. Okay? And what happens, what we get, the analog of that equation that we find in this case, is the following. So let me do something here. Recall that this guy came from the classical string side using the group element omega, which depended on x. So let me add the dependence on x of these functions. All these functions are function of x. Recall x was the spectral parameter which appeared in the string side. Now, what you get here are very similar equations. So they just follow from the fact that you apply this co-derivative to the character. Okay, and by applying this co-derivative to these characters, you quantize the Jacobi-Trudy relation, and then you quantize Hirota, and you get really the quantum Hirota equation, which tells you that T, let me write just the second version, T AS, for a representation AS, of U plus I over 2, T AS U minus I over 2, is equal to T AS plus 1, of u, t a s minus 1 of u, plus t a plus 1 s of u, t a minus 1 s of u. So we see, again, this is from the CFT side, and that is from the string side. Very similar. Okay? Very similar. The only difference is that here we have a functional equation, plus minus I over 2. So the only difference between characters and quantum spin chains is plus minus all over I over 2. It's all in the plus minus I over 2. Otherwise, these quantum spin chains follow, they are just group theory, just characters. And now, let me tell you why these two equations are just particular limits of a universal equation, and this would be the context of AVS, CFT. So let me just write how you make contact between these two equations. So let me recall that this was obtained, this is the description when the coupling is going to zero, and this, as I said in the beginning, is the description when this coupling is going to infinity. Okay? Now, to merge the two, we introduce a so-called Joukowsky map. So the Joukowsky map is a nice map that engineers use that maps a circle into an airplane wing. Okay? It's a very useful map. You can study the flow through an airplane wing if you know the flow through a circle, which is simple. It's compressible. So let's use this Joukowsky map. And this Joukowsky map is a nice map. It's just x plus 1 over x is equal to u over g. And I really mean that x will be identified with this x, u will be identified with that u. Okay? Then, let's see. So, for at g going to infinity, okay, x is order 1, x is a complex number in C of order 1, if this u is of order g, right? U needs to be of order g when g goes to infinity for this x to be something of order 1. Okay? Then, it means that when g goes to infinity, u is basically the same. You cannot distinguish u from u plus minus I over 2. Basically the same. I mean, to the leading order, it is the same, plus subleading order. You cannot distinguish. Okay? Cool. So maybe, this equation describes any coupling. Because at strong coupling, you would not see this plus I over 2 and this minus I over 2. It would be invisible to you. You would not have the right to distinguish. So maybe, and this would be the ADS-CFT equation for any coupling or for this particular quantity that I'm studying, maybe this is the old equation you need, and when g goes to infinity, this u is very large and you don't care about the I over 2 and you reproduce back this equation. Now, this equation is an equation that you would have different analytic properties, and these are the kind of things that you could do to find the system at any possible coupling. And indeed, these equations can be turned into more useful integral equations. They can be solved numerically. We can obtain interesting quantities out of them. For example, the anomalous dimensions of these operators at any value of the coupling. And we can make these plots and plot the energy as it goes from weak coupling to strong coupling, as we call it. And then we find that indeed, this naive guess works perfectly. And you reproduce all possible predictions, and it seems to be indeed correct. So this was a story about the spectrum. Let me mention, for example, recent development. So this is the simplest possible quantity. And then there are other quantities. For example, recently, we have been studying correlation functions of more than two operators, say three operators. And there, we have the analog at weak coupling of what this kind of equations could be, or some family of these equations in some classical limit as well, as here. So say on to study what we call three-point functions, is something that we started recently doing on this side of the story, and we more or less understand how to do it and how to use these integrable techniques. We don't know yet how to do it at the strong coupling side of the story. At strong coupling, on the other hand, we studied solutions which are not of the topology of a cylinder mapped into the target space, but of other topologies, say the disk topology, other topology, which were quite important. For example, we studied recently some topologies, some surface, finding some minimal surfaces, not which will move on the cylinder, but which end on some general contours on the boundary of antideCetus space. And this is what you do to describe in an integrable way scattering amplitudes of the theory. Those quantities that I told you, that if you would like to do it using field theory, you would have no chance of doing it. But with the DSTFT, we know how to do it. How to use integrability? We know more or less, but how to use it efficiently also at weak coupling, this is something that we don't know. So as usual, we are starting from one side, something we understand here, something we don't there. For some quantities, like the spectrum, as I told you throughout the talk, we managed to find the common language and to make this match. For other quantities, it's something which is ongoing, and this is why it's a very interesting field. Okay, thank you.